the Orb, Volume 1, Number 9. Failure. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. No one really wants to fail, to lose, to disappoint others. It may result in hardship, job loss, or closed opportunities to future benefits. To be labeled a failure is a mark of shame and dread. Last time in The Orb, we looked at expert predictions. History is littered with their errors, yet despite their failures, they still practice their punditry. How is it that some failures are so easily ignored while others can ruin lives? The advertising agency Whedon & Kennedy have a mural in their Portland ad school, WK12, that was created in 2006 by students using over 150,000 clear plastic pushpins. In bas-relief, it spells out in a graceful, fluid script the words, "Fail harder." The message reflects one of Dan Whedon's sayings, quote, "You're only good to me after you've made three tremendous mistakes." In some fields, particularly creative ones like advertising, failure is just part of the game. When ideas are your business, the more ideas you have to offer, the more likely you are to find a jewel gleaming amid the stones and muck. However, in other settings, failure is not considered an option. Who wants to hear their doctor or airline pilot saying something like, "I might not get everything right, but let's give this a try." Where there is a commitment to action that cannot be given a do-over, our tolerance for failure drops to zero. These two edge cases, the easy do-over or the matter of life and death, bound a huge middle ground where the outcomes carry some importance, and with the right attitude of forgiveness, there may be opportunity to try again. In that middle ground, we tend to see failure as more severe than it really needs to be. Usually, the failure amounts to little more than some wasted resources, lost time, lost money, perhaps a missed opportunity. How did we get to this culture of stigmatizing failure? Tim Harford, the author of the book Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failure, appeared on the CBC radio program The Current on May 18, 2011. The program was hosted by Tom Harrington. Asked about the process of failure, Harford remarked that despite the clichés that we should all learn from our mistakes, it has not made it any less difficult to suffer failure.
I mean, the lesson I draw is that failure is pretty much inevitable. We've got long lives, we're going to try a lot of things, and the world is incredibly complicated. Things go wrong all the time. And we are not taught the right way to respond to failure. Many of us believe that a failure simply reflects on ourselves as a person. You know, we're not people who have failed. We have become the failure.
It doesn't matter if the failure was due to limits on our resources. External resources like time, materials, money, and so on, or internal resources like training and skill level. The focus of attention goes to the result. Regardless of how noble the effort, how good the intentions, how difficult the challenge, we judge on the outcome alone. That's not a very healthy way of seeing the world and the imperfection of people. Alina Tugend, author of Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong, also appeared on The Current.
It's not failure that's not an option. It's perfection that's not an option. We have to find ways where we approach mistakes differently.
This aversion almost to making mistakes, our reaction, whether it's individually or as companies, organizations, we punish them. Why?
I think it is pathological to do that. I mean, there are companies who try very hard to have a failure-positive culture, a culture where mistakes are allowed. Pixar, these amazing films are built through group criticism, and they've worked out a way to criticize and improve in a way that seems very effective. So the classic way to criticize is the praise sandwich, where you say, "Hey, it's great, maybe we should change this, but hey, it's really great." And what we hear is we just hear all the "hey, it's great," and we don't hear the criticism. It all gets mushed up. Mm. At Pixar, they have a technique they call plussing, where rather than all this fluff about whether it's great or not, who cares whether it's great? The point is, can we make it better? So you just go straight in and you go, hey, wouldn't it be better if we did this, we added this? So that's why they call it plussing. Can we add this? Can we add this? So rather than try to evaluate whether something is succeeding or failing, just simply go straight in there and in a positive way, just say, this is what we could change to make it better.
But what Tim also was talking about, was a really interesting example, is the process. And I think what we've lost when you say, why are we so scared of mistakes? We're not looking at how the whole process and how do we make things better. It's simply the end result. And if you look at that, then mistakes play no role.
I'm a fan of the old Max Headroom TV series. Their technology genius, Bryce Lynch, sums up the scientific view of failures.
There are no experimental failures. There's only more data.
Evolution by natural selection is a process of trial and error, error being an operative word in that process. The failures are the random mutations that did not enhance survival. The successes led to where we are now, and the process is not over. Someday, Homo sapiens may be viewed as a major failure in natural selection. We just don't know what successes the future has in store in the grand time scale of the planet. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Our man-made systems are just as evolutionary.
There are certain systems of science, evolution, well-functioning markets that pick out ideas that are working. But I think we could get better, especially when we step outside the market system. So if you think about science funding in many countries is very risk averse. And of course, it feels it almost should be risk averse because it's the taxpayer who's funding scientists to speculate. There's a very interesting study comparing an American foundation, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, with the National Institutes for Health, which is a huge government body. They both sponsor scientific research. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute is very conscious about backing people, not ideas. We say, well, your ideas may change, we're going to back you. They back them longer term, and they encourage them to try something that where failure is highly likely, something that's never been tried before. And these two systems have been compared. The National Institutes of Health, which is a very conservative system, produces lots of good work. Mm-hmm. But the real blockbusters, the really outstanding ideas that get cited and cited and cited again, really transform the field, they're more likely to be funded by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which, by the way, also funds an awful lot more failures. And you know what? It doesn't matter that it funds more failures because it's producing the big successes.
Well, if you're the one whose money is going down the toilet on the failures, it still matters. If you're the one whose heart was broken when a relationship failed, it really matters. It seems so simple to say failure is the best way to learn. As true as it may be, it still isn't cheap. It isn't attractive or desirable. We still view failure as shameful, at least in the Western world.
I think that the trouble is everything we're saying, I think people are nodding their heads at and saying, oh, yes, great inventors and great scientists and great thinkers take great risks, but we don't internalize that. And yes, it's not universal. The studies that have been done between people from the U.S. and Canada comparing to how Japanese learn has found, especially in early education, the Japanese are much more willing to focus on mistakes as a process. They're much more willing to let a child talk for a long time about how he added denominators wrong in a fraction. And instead of the teacher, as they would in Canada or the U.S., perhaps say, no, that's wrong. Why don't you sit down? Here's how you do it. They'll go through maybe an entire few lessons, letting the child try to explain and other children and join in on why this was a mistake. Mistakes in that arena are not stigmatized, but they're considered a lesson that hasn't been fully learned yet.
Well, it's interesting to hear Alina say that, because I think here in Europe, we view North America as a pretty failure-friendly place. You know, the idea that at least in business culture, entrepreneurs, they go out, they mess up, they go bankrupt, they learn something. You're not a proper entrepreneur unless you failed two or three times. And I think many business writers on this side of the Atlantic look over with a sense of envy. So it's interesting to hear that actually that may be true in business, or at least that may be the reputation in business, but it's not necessarily true in schools. Mm. But I think it's worth making the point that this is partly about how we bring our children up. And it's partly about the systems that we create, whether they're how we run our politics, whether we're how we regulate our markets. But it's also about who we are as human beings, because I think deep down, for anybody, failure hurts. It really hurts. Mm-hmm. And we have to get over that. Failure hurts more than what you would regard as a comparable success feels good. If you lose $10, that hurts more than finding $10. That's a sort of classic psychological finding. So we have to get over that. Alina, in the beginning of her book, writes about how she wrote a column and she made a mistake and she was embarrassed about it. And then she wrote a column about making the mistake. Mm-hmm. And everybody recognized how it felt. I mean, I'm already getting people writing in and pointing out the mistakes in my book. You know, one of them, and it's, you just feel sick that you made this mistake. Mm. But you've got to get over it. Because right. You can't allow that to stop you experimenting and creating. Because, I mean, if I was that afraid of failure, I just have to stop writing books because there's nothing I can do about it. I'm not perfect. None of us are.
In finding forgiveness, both from others and most importantly from ourselves, we may be afforded the opportunity and the courage to try again. Pushing through failure, learning from failure, or ignoring failure may lead to ultimate success. Still, you may be judged either a triumphal hero or just a wasteful fool.
Listen, lad, I built this kingdom up from nothing. When I started here, all there was swamp. Well, the king said I was daft to build a castle on the swamp, but I built it all the same, just to show them. It sank into the swamp, so I built a second one. That sank into the swamp. So I built a third one. That burned down, fell over, then sank into the swamp, but the fourth one stayed up. And that's what you're going to get, lad. The strongest castle in these islands.
But I don't want any of that.
What happened to our patience? Shareholders call for the CEO's head when a company fails to meet expectations. A sports team has a losing season and the coach gets the axe. Clinical trials for new drug therapies are a form of controlled failure. To sort out which treatment is best, we apply differing treatments under strict control. We expect one to be better than the other. That is, we expect one to succeed and one to fail. We build failure into the process of learning. We could apply these techniques to education, criminology, social policy in general, but we don't. Certainly, I can understand that there are ethical decisions that need to be taken. Some experiments set up the potential for a failing side that is just too high a price to pay for the potential gain. That should not exclude all controlled trials in social policy, where the damage of failure is not likely to be much worse than the status quo. Electoral politics combine with an impatient public to create a high risk for politicians to run trials of social policy. If the new idea fails to improve on the old ways, that political party is heading for defeat. The party fails, not just the idea. This identification of a person or party to an idea is harsh. It has no room for forgiveness, for adaptation and correction. Demands are placed on leaders to somehow know what will work and what won't, no matter how complex and unpredictable our world. Do politics have to be as high reliability as a surgeon or a nuclear power plant? Really? Is it that wrong to spend taxpayer money trying something new that might really make a better society? In late 2009, Connor Field, a Michigan resident, built the largest solar farm in the state. This wasn't a project installed by a major corporation. Field was still a student studying economics and electrical engineering at the University of Michigan. He said, quote, "The goal was to learn how to do it," unquote. And the numerous mistakes his team made were dubbed tuition moments. Failure is a price you pay for success.
How can you make a system safer if you don't embrace your mistakes? The wisest person I ever knew said to me that good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
That was Dr. Brian Goldman of CBC Radio's show White Coat, Black Art. Building an expectation of perfection leads to claims of expertise. This leads to complacency of non-experts and things like the banking collapse. Like our trust in the operators of our high-reliability nuclear plants, we invested trust in the expertise of bankers to not make mistakes with our high-reliability banking system. We stopped looking for their mistakes. We stopped checking their sums. we set our expectations a bit too high. When failure came, as it inevitably does with humans and the systems we create, it hit us pretty hard. That shouldn't happen. My last job in the high-tech sector was as manager of customer support for an enterprise software company. Much of the business was in the healthcare sector, so a system failure was pretty critical. Lives could be in jeopardy. By the time the call came to me, the customer was pretty anxious. Everyone must be aware that software is never bug-free. Most of us have come to expect computer failures. So I found my role was primarily one of helping reset the customer's expectations. People have become pretty good at the things we do. We have come to expect a high level of success. If we could just tone down our expectations a bit, failures might not be quite so painful.
This town ain't big, this town ain't small, it's a little of both, they say. Our ball club may be minor league, but at least it's triple A. We sit below the Marlboro Man, above the Rockville Wall. We do the wave all by ourselves. Hey, Ump, a blind man could have made that call. We like our beer flat as candy. We like our dogs with mustard and relish. We got a great pitcher, what's his name? Well, we can't even spell it. We don't worry about the pennant much. We just like to see the boys hit it deep. There's nothing like the view from the cheap seats. The game was close, we'll call it a win. Go off to toast the boys again. That local band is back in town. They got a kind of minor league sound. They're not that bad, they're not that good, but all in all it's understood. We wanna dance, they wanna play. We wouldn't have it any other way. We like our beer flat as candy. We like our dogs with mustard and relish. We got a great pitcher, what's his name? Well, we can't even spell. We just like to see the boys hit it deep. There's nothing like the view from the cheap seats. Cheap seats. Now the major's called up, oh, what's his name? And one more building rises tall. And suddenly we're all grown up. And this old town's not quite so small. But I'll always miss the middle-sized town in the middle of the Middle West. With no-name pitchers, local bands, and mustard and relish and all the rest. We like our beer flat as can be. We like our dogs with mustard.
J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter series, gave the Harvard commencement address in 2008.
Delivering a commencement address is a great responsibility, or so I thought, until I cast my mind back to my own graduation. The commencement speaker that day was the distinguished British philosopher, Baroness Mary Warnock. Reflecting on her speech has helped me enormously in writing this one, because it turns out that I can't remember a single word she said. I was convinced that the only thing I wanted to do, ever, was write novels. However, my parents, both of whom came from impoverished backgrounds, and neither of whom had been to college, took the view that my overactive imagination was an amusing personal quirk that would never pay a mortgage or secure a pension. I know the irony strikes with the force of a cartoon anvil now, but... What I feared most for myself at your age was not poverty, but failure. However, the fact that you are graduating from Harvard suggests that you are not very well acquainted with failure. You might be driven by a fear of failure quite as much as a desire for success. Indeed, your conception of failure might not be too far removed from the average person's idea of success. So high have you already flown. Ultimately, we all have to decide for ourselves what constitutes failure. But the world is quite eager to give you a set of criteria if you let it. So I think it fair to say that by any conventional measure, a mere 7 years after my graduation day, I had failed on an epic scale. An exceptionally short-lived marriage had imploded, and I was jobless, a lone parent, and as poor as it is possible to be in modern Britain without being homeless. The fears that my parents had had for me and that I had had for myself had both come to pass. And by every usual standard, I was the biggest failure I knew. So why do I talk about the benefits of failure? Simply because failure meant a stripping away of the inessential. I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was and began to direct all my energy into finishing the only work that mattered to me. Had I really succeeded at anything else, I might never have found the determination to succeed in the one arena where I believed I truly belonged. I was set free because my greatest fear had been realized, and I was still alive, and I still had a daughter whom I adored, and I had an old typewriter and a big idea. And so rock bottom became the solid foundation on which I rebuilt my life. You might never fail on the scale I did, but some failure in life is inevitable. It is impossible to live without failing at something, unless you live so cautiously that you might as well not have lived at all, in which case you fail by default. Failure taught me things about myself that I could have learned no other way. I discovered that I had a strong will and more discipline than I had suspected. I also found out that I had friends whose value was truly above the price of rubies.
When my daughter was in grade one, she drew a lot of pictures. She was better than average at it, so says a proud parent. She told me she wanted to have an art sale at her school. Immediately, my parental child protection alarm went off. I did not want her to fail, to feel diminished that people would not pay for her drawings. Thankfully, I managed to tune out the alarm and instead allow her to chase her ambition wherever it would take her. I guided her to get permission from the school to hold a sale on the grounds at the end of the day. She made posters to advertise the event. I arranged for my parents to come so that I could be sure there would be a few sales. On the appointed day, she set out a blanket and laid out her 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. I can't express the scope of my amazement. She was sold out within 10 minutes. Kids started reselling the drawings among themselves for profit. I had not foreseen the desire of a young child to simply make a cash transaction by themselves. This activity was something new to them. Sorry, Dela, it wasn't so much what they were buying, but that it was them doing the buying. Nonetheless, the sale was a massive success for everyone. Dela sold her art, the kids got to do some business, and I learned never to stand in the way of a dream. So get out there and fail harder. Live life. It won't be perfect, but it will be yours. Don't stand in the way of your own success. Thank you. Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cronoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.